Welcome to another episode of 35 West, a podcast at CSIS in which we talk about the 35 countries in the Western Hemisphere, and particularly politics and policy. Today I have with me a guest, Dr. Evan Ellis, who is a professor of Latin American Studies at the U.S. Army War College, an expert on Latin America, and also an expert on Chinese influence in Latin America. Evan, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Evan, before we get started, if you could just give us a little bit of background on yourself. How did you end up in your august position? What is your background?
Thanks for the question. I actually started out for the first 14 years of my career in the private sector, and indeed began following Chinese activities in Latin America from a commercial rather than a security perspective. In 2009, I had the opportunity to begin working at the Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies, basically gives defense education to our partners in Latin America. And 3 years ago, I actually had the opportunity to accept a position at the U.S. Army War College, where I'm doing exactly the opposite, explaining what's important in Latin America to the leadership of the U.S. Army and Department of Defense.
Evan, it's clear that China is playing somewhat of a long game in Latin America. They have been around spreading influence for at least a couple of decades. And most of the activity has been in the economic sphere. Can you sort of, for our listeners, give a broad scope of the Chinese strategy in Latin America and maybe a few good examples to illustrate that strategy?
Sure. The Chinese activities in Latin America have evolved from the inception of the current communist government in 1949 to the present day. Initially, they were mostly focused on political activities, especially in the 1970s and 1980s, convincing countries that recognized Taiwan, the Republic of China, to change that recognition. In the early 2000s, especially after 2001, with China's ascension into the World Trade Organization, trade with Latin America began to expand exponentially. But there are very little activities by Chinese companies on the ground in Latin America until about 2009-2010, when, in response to the global economic crisis then occurring and the advance of Chinese companies, they began to enter broadly across a number of different sectors, particularly in mining and petroleum, in agricultural goods, in factory production, in construction, particularly in the Caribbean and in the ALBA countries, as well as in telecommunications with companies such as Huawei and ZTE, in logistics with companies such as Hutchison Whampoa and China Overseas Shipping and China Shipping, among other sectors, and more recently also in banking. It has involved advances in all countries. So you can find Chinese activities from Mexico, where a number of car companies and petroleum companies are set up, to Venezuela, where, of course, there has been about $62.2 billion in loan-based projects dispersed, to the Bahamas, where, unknown to many people, the Chinese have put about $10 billion into that small group of islands, including the completion recently of a $4.2 billion hotel project called Bahamar. In terms of the major investments, you see everything from the $15.5 billion acquisition of Nexen in the oil sector by CNODC, to seven major mining projects in Peru, including a $5.8 billion acquisition of Las Bambas mine by China Minmetals, which allows China now to claim about 25% of all mining investment going forth in Peru, to major advances in the electricity sector and other sectors in Brazil. For example, the Chinese electricity giant State Grid just completed a $10 billion acquisition of a company called CPFL, among others. And of course, as I mentioned before, you have other activities such as the loans to Venezuela. Overall, the strategy that China's pursuing was mostly economic in its orientation, in terms of allowing Chinese companies to have access to goods, markets, and technologies. And yet, this is something that China has been relatively open about. So, for example, in China's 2008 white paper towards Latin America, its 2016 white paper, and most recently, its five-year plan in its relationship with the countries of CELAC, China has been very open about the vehicles for engagement. They call it the 1+3+6. The three primary vehicles, of course, being finance, trade and investment, talking about six sectors: natural resources, energy, construction, food, IT, and technology. However, the fact that this is a mostly economic engagement does not mean that it's any the less strategic, because it is vital for the continuing growth of China as it's inserted itself in the global economy. And moreover, China faces the dilemma of dealing with a world not of its own making and trying to adjust some of its institutions. And so you find China doing things like working through what it calls strategic partnerships, of which it has seven country partnerships in the region, as well as doing things like trying to revise banking relationships in countries like Chile and Brazil and Argentina to have the greater use of the renminbi as a global currency. And frankly, also working towards the survival and continuity of countries like Venezuela or Ecuador or Bolivia, which actively contest the U.S. values and U.S. agenda in Latin America, something that, frankly, although China does not want to be tarred in an anti-imperialistic campaign, is beneficial strategically for China as it continues its rise.
Thank you. That was a very comprehensive answer. There's always a temptation to look at this as some sort of a monolithic strategy that the Chinese leadership decides this is what we're going to do and it happens. To what extent is that true? Is this part of some master plan, or do you have sort of individual ministries or entities within the Chinese government sort of making independent decisions? And then sort of a corollary to that question, how many of these are money-making enterprises, or are they simply, they need a strategic metal, for instance, or they need to some sort of resource in which it's straightforward, a commodities, not grab, but that's what it's all about. And how much of it is, an economic decision based on a profit and loss motive?
It's a great question. For me, one of the best analogies is that of herding cats, although in the Chinese case, all of the Chinese corporate cats generally understand that they're Chinese cats, Siamese, if you will. However, what you find is that there's a general direction that the Chinese want to take the economy. There is an understanding going back to the Go Out strategy, which is officially blessed in 2002 during the 10th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, of the importance of building these relationships as part of China's strategic economic goals. As China's gone forward in the different sectoral plans that they've had, there's been a recognition of certain sectors in which they want to expand the sophistication of the sector, expand their presence. And those types of activities are backed by the state. They have more generous access to loans, et cetera. But certainly at the embassy level, my experience looking at this from Latin America is that there are minor but important differences in perspective. So, for example, when a Chinese defense firm such as Polytechnologies or the Norinco companies or the Avica Corporation with respect to aviation comes in and does an arms transaction, which might be seen by the foreign ministry as relatively threatening towards, say, the United States, there's a bit of tension, and those things have to be resolved, just as they're resolved when things happen with U.S. corporations and the U.S. ambassador has to deal with those things. But frankly, the Chinese government has a lot more leverage. They have the ability to coordinate, particularly among state-owned enterprises, but even for those companies that are not state-owned, for example, Sany Heavy Industries, which is technically a private company, yet there is a web of influences through the party system. Generally, it's hard to even be the head of a private company without being a member of the party. And at the end of the day, even if one is not a member of the party, there are ways to influence the well-being of the company back in China. So for good or bad, the Chinese government has strong abilities to steer companies in the direction that one wants. And yet there are a number of cases of dramatic failures. So we can talk about some of the infrastructure projects that the Chinese announced that just haven't happened. There are four different transoceanic connections, mostly railroad connections, one across Honduras, one across Guatemala, one across Colombia, and one across the south of Mexico, as well as conversations over things like the Nicaragua Canal that frankly just haven't gone forward. Many projects that have also failed. And so not everything that the Chinese set out to do is done. And yet they continue to advance in a general direction and see where the opportunities present themselves and try to put resources in those directions.
So it's not just in the economic sphere that the Chinese have been active. And this is what I suspect probably keeps U.S. policymakers up at night, not so much the economic and investment and trade relationships, but increasingly the military relationships. Now, we know that China's been friendly to like-minded states like Venezuela, like Bolivia, like Ecuador, but it's also developing relationships with traditional U.S. allies like Colombia, Uruguay, Costa Rica. Can you tell us about those relationships? Are those real relationships? Are those just, you know, essentially photo ops, port calls, and everyone gets on the ship and goes home? And then to the extent they are real relationships, but what is China thinking here? What is their end game in terms of a geopolitical military strategy?
In the military sphere, as in the political and economic spheres, China has a very flexible strategy that applies what I would refer to as strategic patience to work and develop the relationships that it can, and where it has obstacles, wait until the situation changes and it's possible to take new relationships forward. If you go back to the 2008 the policy white paper towards Latin America, the Chinese very openly said that military engagement was one of the types of all-around relationships they wanted to build with the region. They reaffirmed that in their 2016 white paper, and indeed in China's first major military strategic policy document, which was the May 2015 China Defense Policy white paper. It openly acknowledged the importance of maintaining these global military relationships in order to defend China's growing commercial interests and for other non-specified regions. And so what you find is that what they're doing in Latin America is entirely consistent with that, but that does not mean that it is any the less impactful or does not raise the same significant strategic implications for the U.S. position in the hemisphere. So what you find, for example, is a partner like Colombia, arguably one of our strongest partners in the region that, as you alluded to, going back to 2004, 2005, the Chinese were providing $1 to $7 million a year in things like hats for the Colombian High Mountain Battalions, bridging equipment, trips to China for Colombian internationally oriented officers. More recently, that's gradually expanded to include Chinese PLA participation in Colombia's famous Lanceros course in the Tolimaida military base, as well as participation in Colombia's demining courses. You find now that Colombian cadets, for the first time, are one of the leading Latin American partners, sending cadets to the full four-year Mandarin language course in Beijing, kind of like our U.S. West Point. And so little by little, even in a non-threatening way, the relationship's advancing. Same thing with Uruguay, which silently and somewhat distant from the United States, often overlooked, has gone from buying Chinese vehicles, Chery and Geely cars for its Ministry of Defense, to accepting gifts of construction equipment, to having its pilots evaluate the possible, although not yet realized, purchase of L-15 and H-9 aircraft. Places like Guyana, which is very important with the oil.
Evan, could I interrupt you there? Those aircraft, are they training aircraft? What kind of aircraft are the L-15s?
The L-15 is a mid-capable aircraft which can be used as a trainer or an interceptor in a limited role. And depending on who is buying it what their needs are, depends on whether it's used as a trainer or an interceptor.
But it does have offensive capability or could be outfitted for offensive missions or...
Absolutely. In the case, for example, Uruguay, which has almost no intercept capability and which is confronting problems with narco flights, making incursions into its airspace, basically having a cheap, fast jet that you could use as an interceptor is a lot better than having no interceptor capability at all.
And those sales, are those relatively recent, or when were those sales to Uruguay made?
Well, the L-15 sale hasn't actually been made. The Uruguayan pilots actually last year were over in China trying out the aircraft.
Because that seems like a qualitative difference between what you previously described, which sounded more in the realm of, you know, exchanges, non-lethal aid, some equipment, uniforms, vehicles. Is this a step up? Does this represent a new type of Chinese South American mil-mil engagement where you're now seeing more sophisticated weapons platforms or weapon systems, or is that, I mean, how would you assess that?
The Chinese are actually advancing their military engagement across the field, some faster in countries than others. There are three areas that I look at. One is actual PLA military activities in Latin America, where I would emphasize the Chinese in the past 10 years have expanded from multilateral humanitarian engagements, such as its presence in Minnesota, to bilateral but still humanitarian engagements, such as doing exercises involving mobile field hospitals with Peru, to more complex bilateral exercises, such as the deployment of their hospital ship, the Peace Ark, to the region now twice, to even limited combat exercises, such as they did with the Chileans. You see the same type of advances in training, where they have gone from bringing Latin Americans to three-week courses in Changping, near Beijing, to beginning to do more extensive things like what I mentioned involving the Colombians in their regular four-year cadet course. And you see the same thing with respect to military sales. Just like cars and just like other strategically valued sectors, the Chinese started out with a privileged client who was willing to give them access, entered basically competing cheaply, and then worked to bring up the quality of their products. And so going from Venezuela, where they sold very low-capability K-8 fighter trainers, moving up the chain there to everything from armored vehicles to MLRS, multiple launch rocket systems, branching out into other countries such as Peru, where they recently have sold a more sophisticated, something called the Type 90B multiple launch rocket system, where they actually beat out a really capable Russian equipment. And so, and even in Trinidad and Tobago, where about 2 years ago, for the first time, the Chinese entered the market for selling offshore patrol vessels, a relatively capable ship for doing patrols that they sold to a neighbor not too far from U.S. shores. And so, like many other areas, the Chinese little by little are expanding their capabilities. And that's something that for the long term should be of concern to the U.S.
So that was going to be my next question, actually. How should the United States think about this, these global aspirations and influence in Latin America? And I presume that this is mirrored by Chinese activities in, or are they mirrored in China, in Africa or Southeast Asia or something? Or is it just Latin America, something special about the Western Hemisphere? But to follow up on that question, is this something the United States really needs to worry about? Or, you know, this is clearly not the Cold War Part Two, or is it? What is going on here and how does the United States need to deal with it?
As I look at Chinese behavior in different regions, I continue to come back to the notion that the basic Chinese strategy has not changed. It is adapted based on the conditions of individual countries, and different regions have different mixtures of countries and different levels of Chinese familiarity. So what you see when you look at Africa, for example, is that China had stronger initial relationships with Africa since it had worked with many of those countries in the 1970s and 1980s in the wars for national liberation. Also, the physically greater proximity caused China to feel a greater level of comfort than they did operating so close to the United States and ours, so to speak, backyard. And so many of the things that have happened in Africa with respect to counter-piracy operations of the PLA Navy, later the deployment of major military forces under the auspices of UN peacekeepers in places like Darfur, and most recently the establishment of a full military base in Djibouti. These type of things are indicative of the type of behavior as Chinese confidence expands elsewhere in Latin America you can expect to see. And indeed, you see that some of the same economic strategies in terms of leader-to-leader deals that China applied in places like Angola and Mozambique, they have successfully applied in places like Venezuela. Perhaps the difference with Latin America is that when you look at countries like Chile or countries like Colombia or countries like Brazil, China has faced more hurdles in Latin America, not only because it's less familiar with the landscape, but also because you have more nations with strong institutionalization, which offer a lot of pushback to Chinese competitors. But in terms of the impact on the United States, and of course this is the question, you see broadly is, even setting aside the question of the military for a moment, that as China expands its influence as a principal purchaser of the commodities of these nations, as it increases its soft power as a local actor on the ground, as it increases its leverage as an investor and a provider of loans, in some cases seen politically and in other cases not, that undermines U.S. influence as we try to pursue our own type of policy agenda, whether it's U.S.-style democracy or human rights or U.S. Attitudes regarding free trade. Right now, for example, you can say that across the Pacific, there is a very real and serious debate over what the future trade regime of the Trans-Pacific looks like. Will it be a rules-based regime that protects intellectual property and it makes it a safe playing field for everyone, whether Japan and India and Korea or partners like Chile? Or will it be a Hobbesian world where the country which is best able to use its state to kick down the doors of others is able to take what it wants and other states have to organize to defend itself, which is in many ways where China seems to want to go with its alternative free trade area of the Asia Pacific. And so in many ways, understanding and defining the nature of the Chinese challenge and how, even though principally economic, it presents very, very grave implications for the type of world that we in the United States want to create and want to live in, that understanding that and understanding how to respond to that really is the question perhaps of our time.
Evan, thank you very much. I feel like I've been to grad school in the last 20 minutes. I mean, I studied this, you know, Latin America for a living, but I've learned a lot from you. So thank you very much. If you enjoy 35 West, I would ask our listeners for a favor. If you could go to iTunes and leave a rating or review for us, it really helps out quite a bit in launching this podcast. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us on 35 West, and we look forward to seeing you next week.